The remainder of Trei Asar, the Svarim of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, are very significant compared to what we've been learning up until now. Everything we've learned until now has had to do with Yehoshua Shoftim, the period of settlement of Eretz Yisrael, of building it, the first Beis HaMikdash, the construction of the first Beis HaMikdash, and then all of the entire period of the first Beis HaMikdash. And then finally, the last several Svarim have been dealing with the upcoming and then current contemporary Churban of that Beis HaMikdash. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are different. They are from a transitional period as we move into the second temple, the second Beis HaMikdash period. And in fact, Rabbi Chaim Angel, in a wonderful book about Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, points out that Tanakh fittingly devotes a significant amount of space to the narrative and prophecies of the second temple period. In all of the perukim that we have in Tanakh, there are 929 perukim, including the five books of the Torah as well as all of Nach. Of those 929, 129, roughly one-eighth, are comprised of Second Temple era books, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Divrei HaYomim, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. So one-eighth of all of Tanakh is about this time period. And it's a very important one. And the first ones, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, are written, according to Chazal, by members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who is the most important institution of this time. It's a transition from prophecy to the rabbinate, from Torah Shebichsav moving towards Torah Shebaal Peh. And so these Sfarim are very significant, and yet we don't learn them all that often. They seem to be a little confusing. They're late in Nach, and most people, as we have said over and over again, don't learn a whole lot of Nach. But beginning when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and the Gullus Bavel began in 586 before the Common Era, certainly over the next 70 years that were prophesied by Yirmiyah that were going to come between the first Beis HaMikdash and second Beis HaMikdash, and the math on that was so confusing that Chazal tell us that many of the kings of the empires who subjugated the Jewish people miscounted. Belshazzar, Achashverosh, Haman, not an emperor, but as we've learned in Megillas Esther, a very important figure at the time. It's interesting, though, that something big is missing. As we know from the Chazal, that when the second Beis HaMikdash was built, the elderly people wept because they knew what was missing from the first Beis HaMikdash. And what's ironic about that, of course, is that considering it was really a bit more than 70 years because of all the construction time, because of the interruptions, there were very, very few elders who would have seen it. And then, more importantly, because so few of the Jewish people returned to Eretz Yisrael to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, there was even significantly fewer people who were going to be present when the second Beis HaMikdash was actually constructed. And so that's a sobering thought, and that's one of the themes that's going to come up a lot, is the lack of seeming support by Klal Yisrael for this rebuilding effort because of a variety of reasons. Either because they were too beaten down by the Gullus, or more unfortunately, because they were too comfortable in the Gullus, because they didn't see the purpose of rebuilding with a subservient state of Judea without true independent nationhood in a much bigger world with a lot more enemies who were looming over us and influencing us in many ways. Now the leaders who are going to make all this happen at the beginning are Zerubbabel and Yehoshua, and we're going to meet both of those when we learn Sefer Haggai. Zerubbabel was the heir to the Davidic line, but he was not Malchus based off it, because we're not going to have a Davidic king again in these Sfarim or afterwards. So he can be a political leader, and he may have been a man eligible to be Mashiach ben David. And we see that a lot in Haggai and Zechariah, but he never got to fulfill that fate. And sharing with him was Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, the grandson of Serachiah the Kohen Gadol, killed by the Babylonians during the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And so there are deep connections and very direct connections to the leadership of Klal Yisrael from before the second Beis HaMikdash was constructed to once the second Beis HaMikdash was constructed. And we'll talk about some of these things with Haggai. The story of Haggai actually begins in Sefer Ezra, where Haggai is first mentioned. We don't know much about him directly, as we'll see in our first shiur. But what interests me greatly is the idea of how the Jewish people didn't really join in. And Rabbi Beryl Wein has a tremendous chapter on this called Reactions to Jewish National Sovereignty. In his book on Trey Usser, when I got to meet him in person, he was signing it in Manhattan, and I went to go hear him speak and to go meet him. He signed my book. He gave me best wishes with any Navi Shiurim I might be doing, because I said I was learning Navi. And he says, the mentality of exile, even of a relatively short and benign exile, was very hard for the people to discard, despite all the deprivations of independence and national uniqueness, which exile inexorably causes. The Jews were fond of their existence in the societies of Babylonia and Persia. We see in the opening books of Ezra, God willing, we'll get to that, we'll learn Ezra together, how Klal Yisrael was either apathetic or, as Rabbi Wein says, a combination of inertia. People don't just get up and leave the familiarity and seeming security of their present abode. Rabbi Wein once said in a shiur he gave in the early 1980s that I've never forgotten since I first heard the tape. He said, Mashiach is going to be inconvenient. You know, the Super Bowl is next week. I'm about to pay off my mortgage. What do you mean I got to get up and leave? But also a recognition of the enormous spiritual, social, and economic problems that faced the nascent Jewish Second Commonwealth that inhibited Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. There's rabbinic tradition, he says, from the Gemara in Yuma, that the apathy of the Jews of the exile towards rebuilding the national Jewish homeland at the onset of Second Temple times was one of the factors that would lead to the eventual collapse and defeat of that commonwealth centuries later. The prophet was successful in abolishing Tisha B'Av and Shivasar B'Tammuz and Tzom Gedalia. Apparently he was not nearly as successful in changing the Jewish mindset. There is a stubborn streak within the Jewish people, and I'm sorry to be quoting so much, but he really captures what these Sfarim are going to show us. We never want to let go of the experiences, customs, and lifestyles developed in exile. Even though Galus is viewed throughout the Nevi'im as a form of divine punishment, detrimental to Jewish life and development, most of Jewish history has occurred while the Jewish people were in exile from the land of Israel. All of the institutions that we build, all of the Torah that we learn. Talmud Bavli, compare that to Talmud Yerushalmi, and think about how much more the lingua franca of learning that is. In the words of the prophet Yechezkel, Hashem assured us he would not allow a scenario to permanently develop that we were going to assimilate into everybody else, and that he will outpour his anger and threaten us if we try to become like all the other nations. But Jews still treasured exile in their newfound homes in Babylonia, Persia, and Egypt. Great scholarly and prosperous Jewish communities were established in these countries. The hold of exile on the Jewish people is a constant phenomenon in our history. It has not departed from us, even in our time. So many Jews prefer to live in seemingly gilded exile enclaves, whether we're talking about Bedford Avenue or Lakewood or Los Angeles, rather than face the challenges inherent in living in the state of Israel. The trauma associated with the task of nation building can lead to confusion and disorientation. The greatness of the enterprise can be dimmed by the static dissonance of pettiness, personal disputes, frequent frustration that accompany such an enormous project. When these barriers are combined with questionable, if not mistaken, interpretations of Jewish law and lore, the mentality of exile can be maintained, even justified. I am of the opinion that this is the nature of sometimes negative attitude, even of religious Jews, towards the Jewish rebirth in the state of Israel after so many centuries of exile in the diaspora. These Jews are not so much State of Israel deniers as they are nostalgic exile believers. They cling to a belief in the idyllic exile existence that never really existed. Back in the shtetl, we were perfect. We were great. Nobody was Mechal Shabbos. I've given shiurim on this before. I gave a shiur on the nature of Shabbos observance in America, and the impression always is that in Europe, everybody was Shomer Shabbos. In Mir, wonderful book, written by somebody involved in the Aguda, about how there was a myth that in Mir, nobody was Mechal Shabbos except one guy, which is very much not true, because they had a whole bunch of Chilul Shabbos organizations in the 1870s and 1880s. Despite the fact that as religious Jews, we pray three times a day for the restoration of Jewish sovereignty over Tzion and Yerushalayim, and the ingathering of our exiles in the Shemana Esrei, The train of Jewish destiny is currently leaving the station for the land of Israel, but regretfully, there are still too many Jews who do not wish to catch that train. Now, there's obviously more complicated factors in that. He points out, as we'll learn in Sefer Zechariah, the idea of the Kohen wearing begadim tsoim, soiled garments. And Rabbi Wein says later in his chapter that we have far too many leaders of the state of Israel who are wearing soiled garments, and it becomes very, very hard to figure out whether or not Eretz Yisrael is the fulfillment of all of the nevuah that we've had. But there's a hold that Golus has on us. And the underlying message in a lot of this, and I mentioned it in my last shiur on Megillas Esther, the idea that on Shushan Purim, we don't lay the Megillah in Shushan. The only place we lay the Megillah on Shushan Purim is in Yerushalayim. But the King Achashverosh, Mas al Oretz v'yei hayam, life went back to normal and we preferred to live in Persia than we did to go back to Eretz Yisrael. And this is not a fervent plea for Nevesh B'Nevesh or Aliyah. This is a recognition of the fact that we have to watch out, because when we get too comfortable in Golus and when Golus gets too good a hold on us, when we are living, as we'll see in the beginning of Haggai, in our paneled houses, and yet we don't want to build a Beis HaMikdash for HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the place, the Eretz that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised to us, then we're missing out on something in our generation. And Chazal see that often as a missed opportunity for Mashiach. Mashiach could have come, but what? But us. This is not like we saw often in Yechezkel, Yirmiyah, Yeshaya, talking about the punishment we deserve for our chatoyim. This is a little bit more about a kind of insidious attitude. And as an American Jew myself, who lives comfortably in America and questions how easy it would be for me to relocate to Israel and start over there, I'm not sure. But I do know that ultimately the message is we're going to keep on moving until we settle in the one place with our Kadosh Baruch Hu has promised us. So I'm sorry, a very lengthy introduction to Haggai Zechariah Malachi, but I think a very important one, because we're transitioning away from the period of Nevuah, heading towards the period of Ksuvim and the period of the end of Nevuah openly, and towards Hester Panim, as we saw in Megillas Esther. And it's a very appropriate time to stop and think, what does it mean when 90%+ of the Jewish people don't join the effort to rebuild a Beis HaMikdash? A Beis HaMikdash that would last 400 years, plus, and yet most Jews are not connected to it or available to it. I gave a shiur once on the Korban Pesach, where I pointed out that 80% of the Jews never went to Korban Pesach once the kingdom split after only 29 years. Well, Allah has come of a comma in 400 years of the second Beis HaMikdash. How many Jews went to bring their Korban Pesach b'Oyla Rega? When it did exist, we didn't go. And now it doesn't exist, we don't go. Maybe shouldn't be such a surprise. So I'm not chas v'shalom criticizing the Jewish people. Think about all the great chazal who lived in Chutz Laretz, in the Golos. Think about the Chafetz Chaim and the Gra and all the recent Rabbanim and great Torah scholars that we've ever had. Think, of course, about the ancient Torah scholars who lived in Golos, in Talmud Bavli. I remember every time they talk about being buried in Eretz Yisrael and Halavai, it's a wonderful thing to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. But the only time we're going to go is when we're dead, we're going to be buried. And what about all of the incredible Torah figures in the history of the Jewish people who are buried in Chutz Laretz? From the Maharal, who never got to leave Germany, who was buried out there and whose grave still exists through a nace almost after the Nazis, to the Chafetz Chaim, to the Vilna Gaon. None of the greatest people, far above anything I'll ever achieve, are buried in Eretz Yisrael. So burial in Eretz Yisrael by itself is not a catch-all universal curative. It's something well worth concentrating on, but at the same time, we also need to concentrate on our attitude while we're alive. So I'm sorry, that's my Moser Shmuz for the day. 14 minutes, ay, 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 I'm going to get yelled at for this one. But let us begin with Haggai in the next year, and then we'll start covering some ground. By the way, Sefer Haggai is one of the shortest Sfarim in all of Nach, only 38 psukim. So we'll be able to get moving quickly.